Hello. When describing her work, Marianne Salmon says she writes line by line. I asked what she meant, and she recommended to me The Art of the Poetic Line by James Longenbach. I was surprised to find his prose became a top influence on my understanding of the endless possibilities of poetry. I am very honored and excited to be up here tonight introducing the speaker who's about to follow. He's written numerous books of poetry and prose, three of which we've studied in the poetry program in the past semesters. With a bachelor's from Trinity College and a PhD from Princeton, he has received numerous awards, including Guggenheim Fellowship and Mellon Fellowship. He is currently the John Henry Gilmore Professor of English at the University of Rochester. His writing not only challenges the mystery of poetry, but deepens it. I was enchanted by his clear explanations and the passion for poetry that bounces off the page. At the same time, his own poetry is crisp, mysterious, funny, and sweet, and a complete joy to read. Please join me in welcoming James Longenbach.
Thank you, Morgan. That was really nice. It's been a really nice day here. I've enjoyed talking to many of you, and I've enjoyed being here in every way, so thank you. I'd like to begin with a poem that is called Suitcase. No one can predict the size, the shape, or even the location of the room where you will spend a long time. But every time you pack, you're thinking about that room. You're imagining the color of the draperies. You're deciding the desk should face the window in summer when the sun is overhead, but face the wall in winter when the light's so low it hits you in the eyes. In winter, there are no distractions. You study the wall. But in summer, the trolley stops in front of the Ministry of Public Instruction. Usually it sits there. Nobody moves. But sometimes it's crossing the river. Little houses, new apartments, bodies smelling fresh in the morning, rank at night. When I pack, I lay out every sock, each pair of shorts without a fold. If my shirts are too large to lie down flat, I tuck their arms beneath their sides to fill the suitcase perfectly. A window, the desk, a lamp, and a chair. One of life's greatest pleasures, if you'll permit me that phrase, is packing a suitcase. It's not like building a fire when you want to leave space for air. This is called A Little Story, which would suggest that it is a narrative poem. A Little Story. In the village was a restaurant, a bistro, you might say, though really it was someone's home. In the kitchen, I could see a stove no larger than our own, and by the time we ordered, there was no more chicken, only lamb. The locals ate there every night. The next morning, we walked to the market. We filled our satchels not only with fruits and vegetables, but with oils, spices, a set of wooden spoons. We scrubbed our refrigerator. We bought more food than it could hold. But at the end of the day, it was not fatigue that returned us to the restaurant. It was habit, as if we'd lived in the village all our lives. Probably we lingered over the wine. Surely we walked home. The leaves would have been turning. It was September. The moon, a little dollop of red fire. I realize that all my life, I've rarely spoken this way. Nihilism was my defense against the glamour of fortitude. But in the paths of creation, in the darkness and the light, things seem bad when really they're at variance with other things. With things we may not see, they're in accord. Then they are good. In themselves, too, they are good. The next morning, when we awoke to find the restaurant was gone, the shutters closed, the few chairs scattered at the curb, I asked the earth if we should stay here, make this our home. Earth said, "You must never leave. You must stay here forever." You might have noticed, or you might not have, when I was reading that, that I was pausing, perhaps just slightly exaggeratedly at particular moments in the syntax. And I find myself needing to do that because in that poem and in the one I'm going to read next, which is in the same form, what I've done is when I set out to write a couple of narrative poems, the poem that I read to reinvigorate my sense of what a great narrative poem was Shakespeare's Venus and Adonis. And part of the splendor of that poem are these fabulous five-line stanzas that it's in. And you feel that each five-line stanza is this perfect little enclosed unit. And yet, there are a zillion of them creating this narrative. And I tried in ways to replicate that. So in reading them, while these five-line stanzas are formally complete in particular ways, they are never syntactically complete. So you will feel, and I'll do it a little more strongly this time, the pulse of these pauses at these junctures where between, as it were, in the terms of what I was talking about this afternoon, the disjunction between the form of the poem and the structure of the poem. And it just gives me pleasure to read it this way. And if it seems unnatural to you, just be patient. It'll, by the end, it'll feel really cool and charismatic. This one is called The Academy. Oh, and then I'm going to follow this by reading a slightly longer poem in five parts, and I want to move directly from this poem to that one. I'm not going to say anything in between because I like the way they follow each other. The Academy. Reluctantly, having returned to the very neighborhood I'd once called home, I was staying at a small hotel. I tied my tie, untied it, then tied it again. I took the elevator to the lobby, exited the revolving door, but the longer I walked, the less attention I paid to detail. The city's accretions, the shops, the people who frequented them, they no longer distracted me from the underlying contour of earth, which rose precipitously, then fell away, so that just by walking forward, walking straight, suddenly I saw for miles, and then, without adjusting my goal, saw only my feet. One minute I stood at the edge of a great escarpment overlooking the sea. Then rocks I'd climbed gave way to a level plain. There were fields of lavender, and in the distance, what appeared to be a monastery perched at the top of a hill. I took off my jacket. I loosened my tie. I was anxious about getting lost. But time had taught me only too well the impossibility of attaining in the world the world I'd known, as Proust says in The Past Recaptured. He's at the party at the house of the princess. It's been a long journey, and he speaks of himself unthinkingly as a young man, which makes everybody laugh. When I arrived at the academy at the top of the hill, I found my place card, took my seat. I ate the appetizer, then the main course, and like everyone, I endured the ceremony at which many names were called, including finally my own. The phrase, a young man, is one my mother might have used. My mother, for whom I was still always a child. And if, as I heard my name, I registered certain changes which had taken place since childhood, I judged them from the perspective she did, one thing having followed another unpredictably, but with purpose. The Crocodile. One. What I wanted was to lift my body in unnatural postures high above the earth, to dance, to live beyond ideas. Imagine feeling assured you were beautiful. Girls wanted to run their fingers on my skin. Also guys, I bit off their hands. If called to, I could wait beneath the water a long time. I could let a bird pick leeches from my tongue. So in the moment of youth when other people embrace passion, I fell back on discipline. My throat was capable of many different sounds, but the pleasure was in keeping silent, letting parts of me be seen. Sometimes a plover mistook me for a log, but that's not deception. I really look like a log. I survived the great extinctions. I pretended to be myself. To let you know me, I need only move my eyes. Two. Like me, you had a father and a mother. You grew up in a particular place, a particular time. Your skin displays the scars of that place. You've decapitated chickens, eviscerated live fish. You carry yourself with what to other people seems aplomb, but the impulse driving such behaviors, necessary in themselves, has infiltrated daily life. In arguments, you'll drag another person underwater until he drowns. Though I grew very large, though I developed great capacity of mind, I was afraid of my mother. Afraid not just of scrutiny, but of the object, but of being the object of someone's pride. What was I protecting? She was willful, yes, but tiny, generous to a fault. In Egypt, the family crocodiles were adorned with bracelets, earrings of molten gold, then mummified, laid out in the tombs. The word itself is from the Greek, crocodalus, pebble worm. Three. What manner of thing is your crocodile? It is shaped, sir, like itself. And it is as broad as it has breadth. It is just so high as it is, and it moves with its own organs. It lives by that which nourishes it, and the elements once out of it, it transmigrates. What color is it of? of its own color, too. 'Tis a strange serpent. 'Tis so, and the tears of it are wet. 4. As a child, I was given a stuffed crocodile. Don't think this strange. Most humans have dolls resembling themselves. My sister had one too. Tiny marbles filled the sockets of its eyes. The skin was stitched together up the belly where it's soft, and though it was only a foot, perhaps 10 inches long, the jaws were clamped together with a tack. Presumably this kept the little row of teeth from hurting you, but the tack protruded from the bottom of the chin, sharper than any tooth. I remember rubbing over it, back and forth. When my mother died, I was right beside her. She'd been unconscious for a day. My sister and my father were there too. I leaned down close to her left ear. I whispered, "Thank you for everything you did for me. Thank you especially for what you did for my girls." Then, immediately, the color left her face. She was no longer in her body, and she slipped beneath the lagoon. 5. Picture, by way of analogy, a mountain range. Some interruption of traffic, perhaps a flood, has blocked the roads. But communication between the villages is maintained over steep footpaths, the kind used ordinarily by hunters, originally by their prey. Some people speak more openly by inefficient means, and the steeper the path, the more arduous the climb, the more likely we are to believe them. Someday I won't be hungry. I'll watch an egret stepping through the reeds. The miser imagines there's a certain sum to fill his heart, but for sorrow, there is no remedy. It requires what it cannot hope. We've known each other, Earth, a long time. When the light rests low on the Nile, the Ganges, the Everglades, I could be anywhere. Day is discontinued, motionless. A voice is what you have. The poems I'm reading are from a forthcoming book that's called Earthling. And perhaps you know, as I didn't until relatively recently, that the word earthling is one of the oldest words in the English language. It was supplanted by the word plowman in the 14th century. It's our original word in the language for someone who works the earth. And in Anglo-Saxon poems, when you see earthling, that's what the word means. So while I like the way that this title, you know, has a, you know, the ghost of David Bowie in it or something, I'm of course pointed to and recuperating these original meanings for the word. And as you may have noticed, Earth becomes a kind of character throughout these poems, and a sense of one being the little earthling in that big place is what the poems are trying to capture. Let me read a couple of shorter ones again from this project. This poem is called, the phrase may ring a bell, Lyric Knowledge. F- Finally, having cleaned out the closet, I awoke to find it filled with things. Somebody else might need those things, so I put them in a box. I put the box at the curb. The next morning, after breakfast, the closet once again was full. Once again, I cleaned it, this time retaining things unfamiliar to me, discarding the rest. In my mind, these acts of accumulation transpired as quickly as the acts of dispersal. A single night, a single day. In fact, they took many years. In one of those years, I wrote a book. Rather than discarding things outright, I redeployed them, altering their function. But at the end of the year, I nonetheless found myself at the curb. I greeted my neighbors. I was greeted in turn. Do not imagine we were sad. We were servants, united by a fate much more substantial than our own. Together, we watched the cars go by. The cars followed the road. Above our heads, the leaves turned silver in the breeze. One last thing. This morning, which began like any morning, my wife went running with the dog. She tied her sneakers. She secured the collar around his neck. After they disappeared into the woods, the dog, as was his habit, stopped to pee. My wife looked off into the branches, which were laced with snow. And though the leash was tight in her hand, the collar fastened to the leash, when she looked back, the dog was gone. How could she come home without the dog? How could she explain not simply that he'd run away, but that he'd vanished? No shadow, no narrative, a smudge of white against white snow. Truthfully, I witnessed none of this. But I can attest to the fact that when she returned, the dog was trotting beside her. No conclusions, observations. I brewed the coffee, retrieved the paper from the stoop. Without dislodging a single flake, a cardinal settled on a branch. It is imperative when reading some of these poems that I not laugh and I not make you laugh, but I find them actually, that one in particular, kind of side-splitting, and I find it kind of hard to read it without sort of breaking up. But we made it through together. Thank you for doing that. It made me think of something else here. Always good to break the plan, isn't it? Yeah. Huntington Meadow. Though I come from a long line of people intimate with the bodies of horses, today, for the first time, I touched a horse. I placed my hand on its left flank, just behind the shoulder. The horse was standing beside me, eating grass. I'm speaking here of things that come to feel essential, though they happen at one moment in time. You've never done it. Then you've done it before. You're good at it. You can't imagine your body without it. Tangere, up with an olive. Nobody home. The brine still unexpected at the bottom of the glass. When I touched the horse, I didn't move my hand. The hide, more skin than hair, the muscle beneath it visceral, relaxed, more like a lover's than a dog's. Then, after I took my hand away, I immediately put it back. The horse seemed all the while perfectly happy, ripping up grass at the roots. That was the only sound, the sound you hear when you're gardening, weeding the lawn. Somebody right there beside you, also weeding, though because you lack nothing, you're also completely alone. Here's another one of those sort of narrative things in the five-line stanzas. It's called Book Three. Long ago, before you were born, I lived in a house at the edge of a forest. It was a yellow house. You've heard me speak of it before. Much of what happened in the house was interesting, even amusing, but at times I felt weighed down by a sadness impossible to overcome, as if I lived at the bottom of a dark pit, no prospect but a slender aspen tree against the sky. Languidly, but not idly, one morning I began to draw the tree. Its lines insisted upon being followed, and as one branch rose from another, finding its place in the air, the tree became more beautiful. By laws finer than any known to me, the tree composed itself, and when at last it was there in front of me, looking back, everything I'd ever thought about trees had disappeared. As for the pit, the furies, the snakes, the gloomy caverns and the burning lakes, and last and most, if these were left behind, the avenging horror of a conscious mind, they neither are nor were, nor ever can be. Lucretius, On the Nature of Things, Book Three. All my life, I prayed I'd die quickly. But if death were but the absence of consciousness, like a long sleep unbroken by dreams, I wouldn't be able to see you. Neither could you hear me speak. You're looking out the window, your feet on a chair. Anyone who didn't know you would presume you're waiting for something to happen. But in fact, it's happening now. Preface to an unwritten book. Probably you never noticed the portrait hanging beside the stairs. a young woman, though now she'd be about my age. I had it painted when she died. Somehow, in the 50 years since then, this house has grown up around her. The few books written, the many I've read. But in summer, in early evening, there's really nothing I'd rather do than sit here on the stairs. We work in the dark, as Henry James once said. We do what we can. We give what we have. As for the book I'm supposed to be writing now, if you think I should do it, Jim, I will. But you should realize I'd much rather spend my time reading, or, since it's the end of summer, sitting. Our truest impulses are so immature that most of us can't recognize them, much less have the fortitude to carry them out. I've needed to remain mysterious, even to me. That poem is written about a teacher I had who was very important to me, and it's sort of collaged out of things he said to me or the few letters he wrote to me and pulled together. Well, he died recently, so I had been thinking about him and enjoyed resurrecting his language in that way. I'm going to end with a slightly longer poem. It's not too very long, and it's in 9 parts. Some of those parts are really short, so it's like 7.5 parts, really. And it's called Climate of Reason. I don't usually say this, but it seems appropriate to say here that in the final section, I will refer to 2 people by name, Don and Claudia. But since I know that many of you are great, avid readers of contemporary American poetry, I don't mind saying that those 2 people are friends of mine, both of them wonderful poets whom you probably know, Donald Revelle and Claudia Keeler. Climate of Reason. 1. Whenever I find myself growing grim about the mouth, whenever it is a drizzly November in my soul, I get myself to the desert, where there is only rock and sand. Just thinking about it, making sentences about it, some of the words borrowed, some of them my own, is almost enough. I bring a water bottle and a book. At this point, the same thing always happens. I pour the water on the ground. As quickly as it leaves the bottle, glistening for a moment in sunlight, the water evaporates. Sometimes I spend the night there, curled up on the sand. I imagine the beasts of the desert circling me, lions and wolves protecting me. But most nights I return to the house from which I came. I sleep in a bed where recently another man died. A headboard, 2 pillows, a quilt that someone long ago stitched by hand. When I return to the desert the next morning, a tree has grown up where I poured the water. All day I sit beneath its branches. 2. Enfeebled by prolonged fasting, the hermit finds himself unable to concentrate on holy things. His thoughts wander. Memories of his past evoke regrets he can no longer suppress. And as memory begets memory, he turns ever more deeply into himself. He rehearses his flight from home, his mother, her perfume. He remembers his visit to Alexandria, the sights of the luxurious city, the slender bodies of both girls and boys. Involuntarily, he yields to the dissatisfaction growing inside him. He laments his solitude, his joylessness, his poverty. Grace departs from him. Hope burns low in his heart. He dreams of the Maccabees slaughtering their enemies and desires that he might do likewise with the Alexandrians. He indulges in reveries concerning the riches of biblical kings. The Sphinx, the Chimera, all the abnormalities described by Herodotus he beholds, grotesqueries made animate, a Sabbath of abominations, as if everything inside of him had spoiled. Sand drifts follow the course of the winds, rising and falling like great shrouds. 3. I could go on like this. There's nothing in the desert but time. Time to read, to think, but mostly time to read nothing, to think about nothing. You go there encumbered, needing to be alone, and in almost no time you're lonely, which is what you want, but also what you dread. The landscape stretching far as you can see. Nothing but rubble. Mountains in the distance red against a cobalt sky. 1 minute you're sharing a good bottle of wine. You're eating tortelloni stuffed with ricotta and pear. A little sautéed kale on the side. Then you're in the desert. There's work to do. The desert says, study that tree. What is it like? A silly old man. 4. A certain man, revered by the fathers, was living in the desert of Porphyria. For sustenance, he had a date palm over his head, a small garden at his feet. When the date palm sprouted new branches, he collected the dead ones, thinking they might someday be of use. Have you ever lived alone a long time? Then you know that for the hours when the sun appears unmoving directly overhead, this man was beset with fatigue, as if recovering from a long journey. He turned his head anxiously, first to the left, then to the right, to see if anyone approached. He called to the beasts of the desert that they might return. No one to talk to, nothing to see. So while it was a journey of 7 days to the nearest city, making the conveyance of his handiwork more costly than the sum such handiwork might fetch, he began to weave baskets. Slowly at first, then with great dexterity. The brighter the sunlight, the more intricate his designs. The date palm dropped more branches. The days passed quickly as the nights. And at the end of the year, when his hut was filled to capacity, he burned the baskets, mixing the ashes into the soil. 5. Song of the Desert. Once I was a girl, I fell in love. Against my better judgment, I allowed myself to fall in love. Then I was not a girl. I was the earth. Pour me a glass of water. Once I was the sea. 6, Song of the Basket. Had you permitted it, Earth, I would have loved you like a little bird that picks up crumbs. Seven. Essentially, an artist's work consists of giving life to the dead matter of the material world. That matter is the artist's medium. The artist is in love with it. He may, as lovers do, selfishly expect that what he loves loves him. But if the artist loves the medium enough to submit to its real qualities, refusing to exaggerate how they might please him, the result may justify his idealization. Such artists fear not so much boredom as work without pleasure. In fact, if their work is to succeed, they require boredom. They must wait for its effect. Moments when the artist in each of us created the material world by finding the unfamiliar in the familiar, by finding what we'd never known to be ourselves in what seemed dead. Such moments are forgotten by most people, or else they're guarded in a secret place of memory, too much like visitations of the gods to be mixed with everyday thinking. 8. Before there was the tree, there was the house. Before the house, the bed. Before the bed, the quilt. I could have stayed in the desert forever, except I was hungry. I had to eat. So I returned to the house. I made a sandwich. Dawn was in the kitchen. Claudia was reading on the deck. A rabbit skittered once, then twice, then laid its ears against its head. In the middle of the desert, you might be anyone, except you're never in the middle. You're at the edge. Then, you are yourself again. You look in the mirror. It's like magic. There you are.